Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 16. How Parikshit received the age of Kali, text 22. Kim chatra bandun kali no pashristan. Rastrani vataya varupatani. Itastato vashana panavasha. Snana vyavayon mukha jiva lokam. Kim chatra bandun kalino pasrishtan. Rastrani vataya avaropitani. Atastato vashana panavasha. Snana vyavayon mukha jiva lokam. Kim chatra bandun kalino pashristan. Rastrani vataya virupatani. Itastato vashana panavasa. Snana vyavayon mukha jiva lokam. Vaishnavis, Kim weather, chatra bandun, the unworthy administrators, Kalina, by the influence of the age of Kali, Upasristan, bewildered, Rashtrani, state affairs. Ba, or tie by them. Avaropitani, put into disorder. Ita, here. Tata, there. Va, or ashana, accepting foodstuff. Pana, drink. Basa, residence. Snana, bath. Vyavaya, sexual intercourse. Unmukha, inclined. Jivalokam, human society. Translation. The so-called administrators are now bewildered by the influence of this age of Kali. And thus they have put all state affairs into disorder. Are you now lamenting this disorder? Now the general populace does not follow the rules and regulations for eating, sleeping, drinking, mating, and so forth. And they are inclined to perform such anywhere and everywhere. Are you unhappy because of this? Purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. There are some necessities of life on par with those of the lower animals, and they are eating, sleeping, fearing, and mating. These bodily demands are for both the human beings and the animals. But the human being has to fulfill such desires not like animals, but like a human being. A dog can mate with a bitch before the public eyes without hesitation. But if a human being does so, the act will be considered a public nuisance and the person will be criminally prosecuted. Therefore, for the human being, there are some rules and regulations, even for fulfilling common demands. The human society avoids such rules and regulations when it is bewildered by the influence of the age of Kali. In this age, people are indulging in such necessities of life without following the rules and regulations. And this deterioration of social and moral rules is certainly lamentable because of the harmful effects of such beastly behavior. In this age, the fathers and the guardians are not happy with the behavior of their wards. They should know that so many innocent children are victims of bad association awarded by the influence of this age of Kali. We know from Srimad Bhagavatam that Ajamila, an innocent son of a brahmana, was walking down a road and saw a Shudra pair sexually embracing. This attracted the boy, and later on the boy became a victim of all debaucheries. From a pure brahmana, he fell down to the position of a wretched urchin, and it was all due to bad association. There was but one victim like Ajamil in those days. But in this age of Kali, the poor innocent students are daily victims of cinemas which attract men only for sex indulgence. The so-called administrators are all untrained in the affairs of a kshatriya. The kshatriyas are meant for administration, as the brahmanas are meant for knowledge and guidance. The word kshatrabandhu refers to the so-called administrators, or persons promoted to the post of the administrator without proper training by culture and tradition. Nowadays, they are promoted to such exalted posts by the votes of the people who are themselves fallen in the rules and regulations of life. How can such people select a proper man when they are themselves fallen in the standard of life? Therefore, by the influence of the age of Kali, everywhere, politically, socially, or religiously, everything is topsy-turvy, and therefore, for the sane man, it is all regrettable. Translation again. The so-called administrators are now bewildered by the influence of this Asia Kali, and thus they have put all state affairs into disorder. Are you now lamenting this disorder? Now the general populace does not follow the rules and regulations for eating, sleeping, drinking, mating, and so forth. And they are inclined to perform such anywhere and everywhere. Are you unhappy because of this? Om Ganatimirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militang Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sri Vasudhi Gora Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. In order to understand this verse and its commentary, we need to know what is the ultimate goal of life. Only then can we properly evaluate both our internal situation and our external situation. Whether you live a material life or a spiritual life, those two things are the prime factors. Your internal state of affairs and the surrounding external environment. So that means in order to determine your progress, once you have established your ultimate goal, you need to do an internal scan and an external scan of the environment. And then you can get a grip on your life. It's very difficult for people today to actually get a hand on their own life. How do you define your life? What is it? Are we the body? Are we the mind? What is consciousness? How do we get this body? Why this particular body? Will we get another body? These are essential questions. And of course, once you understand your ultimate goal, then you can sort yourself out. But if we become so distracted by our social, political, and economic affairs, we miss out on understanding what is the ultimate goal of life and making progress toward that ultimate goal. Srimad Bhagavatam, earlier in this first canto, will tell you that the perfection of religion is pure love of God. What is pure love of God? The Bhagavatam itself explains. Devotion to the Supreme without any material motive. No prosperity religion. No piggybacking of one's selfish desires upon your relationship with God. And because of that pure motivation, as the Bible says, love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy might. That pure motivation allows you to proceed with service to God without interruption. Interruptions in our divine service are caused by selfish desires protruding into our devotion. So Srimad Bhagavatam gives the standard for what is the best religion. It doesn't say this religion is the best, that religion is the best, or that one's the best according to one's particular creed that one's adopted, according to one's ethno-religious status. No. Srimad Bhagavatam gives you an impartial criterion. Motivation. Look at the motivation. Are we worshiping God just for fulfilling our desires, or even partially fulfilling our own desires? Or are we having the attitude of, not my will, but thy will be done? That is pure bhakti, or pure devotion. I was speaking across the ocean in New Zealand last week, and I was, somehow or other, I mentioned what I was, things that happened to me when I was 5 years old, because I was raised in a very religious Christian family. And so I told the audience that whenever I would have a crisis when I was 5 years old, like losing my house keys, I would pray to God, oh God, help me find my house keys. If you help me find my house keys, I promise I will glorify you all day. So I explained that in New Zealand, which is a completely secular country, so kind of the whole audience is kind of like blushing, like, whereas I can say it in the USA, because the USA is known nominally as a, quote, religious country, unquote. So I had the right idea that there is an ultimate authority, but my appeal was for my own benefit. Of course, that is better than nothing. But that's an example of materially tinged religiosity. I wanted some material benefit. So at least I recognize that there is a supreme authority. And I was praying, oh God, help me find my huskies. This is a major crisis. Srimad Bhagavatam gives us the first class standard, the ultimate goal of any religious process, which is pure love of God. No material motivation. None of this, God will make you rich. Go to Him for your material cravings. None of that. Simply, how can I be a selfless servant of the Lord? Not my will, but thy will be done. That's the standard of Srimad Bhagavatam for first-class religion. And it's an impartial standard. You may believe this, you may believe that. Very good. You may have this creed, you may have that creed. Very good. You may glorify God through song in this way. You may do it that way. Very good. But the standard by which you judge is the standard of purity in devotion, or what Srimad Bhagavatam calls bhakti. Is my devotion tinged by selfishness? God give me this, God give me that. As Srila Prabhupada, our founder, would often explain, real spirituality does not turn God into your order supplier. Where was I? At a dentist or something a few weeks ago. And, you know, a dentist is not a very pleasant experience. So the dentist was digging into my gums, and it was a bit excruciating. And because the dentist told me, look, if you don't give you an injection, the whole thing will go quicker. So I said, okay, make the whole thing quicker. Just a little bit of pain for a short time, and okay. And it was a bit of pain for a short time. And I had to catch myself, because my natural tendency was, oh, Krishna, help me out. Stop this pain. And I had to catch myself. Wait a minute. That is not pure devotion, and I'm aspiring for pure devotion. But you can see, in spite of our big philosophy, in spite of our very deep and profound theology, when crunch time comes, oh God, give us our daily bread, please. give us our daily painkiller. So once we know what the ultimate goal is, the love supreme, pure love of God, then naturally we want to understand what is God. Because without understanding what is God, how can our devotion be intense? Anyone can comprehend this. When you think you've fallen in love with someone, it's because of their qualities, their activities, their personality. You're attracted, and you're hoping they're attracted to you. So how is it that there can be love of God if we lack information about what is God? The form, qualities, activities, personality. Now, you can imagine yourself walking on campus and you're with your friends and you just happen to point out to a person on the other side of the campus walkway. See that person? You tell your friends, I love that person. Your friends will say, well, that sounds great. What do you know about the person? I don't know anything, but I love him. Your friends would kind of consider, well, certainly you must know something about the person in terms of their activities, their qualities, their personality. No, I don't know anything. But I love that person. Your friends would consider that, well, you're very soft-hearted, but you could be a bit more practical about your life's choices. So similarly, it's nice that we have some attraction to God, to the concept. But for that love to be intensified, we need knowledge of what is God, what is the Father. I was speaking last night at a gathering at our mantra house. And there were 80 young people cramming into the house. And I told them something quite astonishing. Because, you see, once you understand what is your ultimate goal of life, then you can do the internal scan and the environmental scan. See what's inside you in terms of making progress to that ultimate goal, and see what's happening in the atmosphere, the environment around you, whether that is conducive for you to achieve the ultimate goal. Because that's what's going on in this verse today. Although it's spoken thousands of years ago, still, the seers, the Bhagavatam seers, are looking ahead at what will transpire in the current day and age. So they're pointing out, by doing this environmental scan, which includes the far future, which is now, the so-called administrators are now bewildered by the influence of this age of Kali, age of quarrel and discontent. And thus they have put all state affairs into disorder. Are you now lamenting this disorder? Now the general populace does not follow the rules and regulations for eating, sleeping, drinking, mating, and so forth. And they are inclined to perform such anywhere and everywhere. Are you unhappy because of this? Are you unhappy because of these environmental factors that are there, which you'll see when you do the scan? And the external affects the internal, unless you are a very rare transcendentalist, someone who is 100% on the spiritual platform, 100% unaffected by external material circumstances. In other words, you're a perfect yogi, a perfect bhakti yogi. Unless you're that, you have to be honest and admit you will be taking on water. You'll be affected by the ocean of turbulence all around you. So we were speaking a bit about anxiety, which is such a prevalent feature of life in the first world, especially in the USA. The World Health Organization has pointed out that amongst all the developed nations in the world, the USA is one of the least happy. But in terms of anxiety, it is number one by far. indisputable champion for anxiety. Other international surveys have shown that when you measure momentary happiness, you see, let me explain. If some of you may have heard it before, there are two ways that you can measure subjective happiness. One is momentary happiness. A social researcher sends you a SMS message on your cell phone. How do you feel right now in terms of happiness from 1 to 10? Plug in a number. And then 2 hours later, you get another SMS. And how do you feel now? Plug in a number from 1 to 10. So you calculate momentary happiness in terms of that. The other kind of happiness is known as the life evaluation happiness, which means even though I feel bad today, I've actually been feeling bad for a couple of months. When I look at the overall achievements of my life, yeah, it's kind of good, you know. My life has been moving in a good direction. I've got acquisitions. I've got achievements. Overall, my life is, I think, successful, even though I feel lousy and I'm depressed, but that's another. So, momentary happiness. On the scale of the whole world, not simply the first world, but the whole world, in terms of momentary happiness, the U.S. is rated as number 25 behind Rwanda, where there was this massive genocide of a million people slaughtered. So what's going on here? So last night, I was explaining to our audience, which was mainly students and millennials, young persons under 30. So I was explaining that for the adult, for someone who's over 30 in the USA right now, you have a 1 in 3 chance of becoming overwhelmed by anxiety disorder. 1 out of 3 persons has this difficulty. And often the anxiety disorder is accompanied by depression. The two hang out together. So if you're over 30 in the USA, you 1 out of 3 persons will suffer this. In other words, suffer to the extent that professional treatment is required. But it doesn't end there. What if you're under 30? 1 out of 2 persons will have this. Half of all of you under 30 will experience anxiety disorder, often accompanied by depression, but just measuring for the anxiety disorder, enough to warrant professional help. So when I explained this, of course, mouths dropped. Like, oh, we knew there was a problem. We didn't know it was that bad. In fact, the American Psychological Association that takes in all the professional psychologists, has declared that the USA is on the verge of a stress-induced public health crisis. So then I presented to my audience last night the facts from my own alma mater, where I went to, where I did my college studies. Yale University has released statistics revealing that over the course of the students' 4-year undergraduate studies, half of them seek out mental counseling. So this is life at the top, the elitists. Half of them seek out mental counseling because the stress that they went through in high school to achieve the supreme destination is so injurious. And then what happens, you go to such an institution and you realize, well, in high school, I was the smartest person around. But now at this place, I'm just, you know, one amongst, you know, thousands of super smart persons. So you lose your, you know, you lose your sense of self-worth. You realize I'm, you know, I used to be a big fish in a small pond. Now I'm a small fish in a big pond. And that freaks you out. So this is a major factor for anxiety. The pressure to succeed. It's pushing on you from the outside. So much so that you have so many dreams which are loaded into you, downloaded into you from outside, and you try to cope with those dreams, and the result is you're shattering. What are those dreams? We spoke about some of them last night to our crowd. There's the dream of the soulmate. By shopping around, looking and hooking, I call it, some or other, the perfect relationship will arise. Someone who knows what I feel before I feel it. Someone who knows what I think before I think it. We'll be together. We'll be a perfect fit like a hand in a glove. That dream is there. Meanwhile, there's so much suffering from relationship instability. The social statistics show that in 1980, by the time someone was 25, they were married, they had settled down. Now, in just a few decades, that number has jumped. The median average for those who marry is now 30. So, what this means is that all the traditional milestones in life have been swept aside. You go back decades ago to the time of many of your parents, say the 50s, the 60s before the countercultural hit, the countercultural wave. Your life was laid out for you. If you went to high school and didn't go to college, you would take up a trade. If you went to college, then after you graduate, you get a job, and you marry, you buy a house, and you have children. That's all happening by the time you're 28. You've got the job, you've got the family life, you've got a wife, husband, children, and you've purchased your house, you're paying off the mortgage. All by the time you're 27 and 28. All that now is swept aside. And so you're lost. Like, what do I do now? I'll try this. I'll try that. Try this relationship. Try that relationship. Job, I don't know. I've got to find a job that fulfills me. But the economy is such that you got to take whatever you can get. The statistics are that most persons, when they graduate from college, will not get a job in the field that they studied in college. So you put all this focus and meditation into, I'm studying this, I'm studying that, I'm going to be fulfilled, I'm going to be content in this way, and then, hey, be lucky you have a job offer, unless you want to just be a burger flipper. Those are the realities. So you have the dream of the soulmate. And so you shop around, you try this one, you try that one, you get frustrated, you get depressed, but you're convinced the soulmate is out there. And then there's the dream job. As I often explain, it's no longer fashionable to just have a job. Although, these days, you might think one is grateful to have a job, but that's kind of pedestrian. That's kind of ordinary. A job is a necessity. But your heart longs for something more than just necessity. So what's next up on the scale? It's not a job. That's just something you got to do. Hopefully your life is not about the drudgery of just having a job. Next up, a career. I am a neurologist. I am a nutritionist. I am a civil engineer. But a career is all about social status. It's a label that you can kind of wear on yourself, just like a clothes label and profile. I'm a this, And people say, oh, you're that. But what you're supposed to long for, what you're supposed to dream for, is the calling. A job that fulfills you, gives your life meaning. That's what you want. So you want the perfect relationship, you want the perfect job, because those become the parameters by which you measure your internal satisfaction. And guess what? All this dreaming and striving and suffering and frustration is played out on the stage of the social media. Everyone knows what I'm doing, and I know what everyone else is doing. And so you're constantly comparing yourself. Social comparison plays such an extraordinary role. I know the dream can be fulfilled because others seem to be getting it. What about me? Am I a failure? Is there something wrong with me? Let me try harder. Therefore, all this anxiety. So how can a genuine spiritualist who understands that love of God is the ultimate goal of life, how can he or she survive in this day and age? It is true that unless you are a very strong, internally strong spiritual person, you will be influenced by the environment around you. So that is why this verse is lamenting about the administrators of society. If they have no idea how to create an orderly social atmosphere that is favorable for spiritual advancement, you're going to find so much unhappiness. So therefore the question, are you unhappy because of this? Yes. Most persons, practically everyone, is not strong enough to fight off their external influences. Most persons are not transcendentalists, or in the Bhakti Yoga terminology, they're not Paramahansas. A swan is able, from a mixture of water and milk, to separate the two. So the Paramahansa-like person, the swan-like person, is able to always separate out from material circumstances the spiritual essence. But almost everyone is not that strong. We've got so much downloaded into us. You should be doing this. This is the way to be happy. Others are happy like this. Why aren't you? Are you happy at this moment? Are you with the right person? Are you sure you're with the right person? What about your job? Is your job a calling? Are you passionate about what you do? Do you love what you're doing? Think about it. Think about the person you're with right now. They may be good, but they could be better. Think about the job you have now. Is it your calling? Are you passionate about it? And what about your own subjective state of happiness? Are you as happy as you could be? Aren't others more happy than you? Check out the social media. You'll see. So in this way, it takes a very strong person to resist all that. And that means, for the most part, people are going to be ambushed and overwhelmed by their social circumstances. So the job of a genuine governmental administration, wherever in the world, whatever the ethnic makeup of the population, whatever the religious makeup of the population, the job of a genuine administration in society is to make sure the circumstances are favorable for spiritual development. You may say you're this creed, this religion, that religion. But you need to be in a society that orders itself in such a way that you feel inspired to make spiritual advancement. So in this chapter, certain activities so common today are considered extremely injurious, unregulated, illicit contact, sexual contact, gambling, intoxication, animal slaughter, meat eating, these things are considered injurious to a healthy social fabric. And by society plunging into these activities, you can never expect peace. Because these very activities of illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating, and gambling lead to frustration, anger, and violence. How many would dare think that the source of the environmental violence, the violence that we're showing to others, to other creatures, to the animals, and to nature, is because of our activities that produce such a toxic mentality of exploitation? So everyone wants to be happy, sure, but we don't recognize the root cause of our unhappiness. It's our activities, our indulgences, which our external environment promotes as this is the way to be happy. So we've been brainwashed. We've been bewildered, thinking that what will lead to satisfaction, even temporary satisfaction. Often people tell me, Swami, what's wrong with temporary satisfaction? We know it's all temporary, but at least it's something. Give us a break, you know. We've got a body. We've got senses. We got to do something, you know. If all we know is temporary gratification, then it's natural, it's actually not natural, but it seems natural that we'll just strive in that way because of a lack of higher experience. We need to know how to use our senses for non-material purposes. And then our love of God is complete. First of all, we need knowledge of what is God so we can be attracted. Otherwise, our attraction will be very weak and will be easily overrun by material influence. And then, when there's knowledge of God, we need to know how to apply that knowledge. And that application involves our senses. So either our senses act in a low way, or they act in a high way for our purification and uplift. So this is the science of bhakti, pure love of God. Of course, the science of bhakti recognizes that there can be lower levels of bhakti in terms of approaching God because of wanting material fulfillment. But Srimad Bhagavatam clearly says in the beginning, that kind of religion is, the Sanskrit term is kaitava dharma, cheating dharma, cheating religion. Because you're depriving yourself of what will satisfy your soul. The only thing that will satisfy the soul is pure love of God. No material motivation, no selfish motivation. So therefore, Srimad Bhagavatam, from the very beginning, sweeps out any material motivation for approaching God. It's giving you the pinnacle of the love of God experience. Not my will, but thy will be done. How can the tiny part of the Supreme coordinate 100% for the pleasure of the Supreme? That is pure bhakti. But as long as we are distracted by injurious activities, and this chapter lists them all, unregulated, unrestricted, illicit connection, meat eating, gambling, intoxication, those things destroy the fertility of the social atmosphere necessary for spiritual development. And so we can't even see what is real religion because we're so overwhelmed by our bodily demands. Our bodies aren't accustomed to regulation, discipline, and sense control. And in this way, it becomes very difficult to see what is the ultimate goal of life and to make progress toward that ultimate goal. So finally, out of compassion, you find these verses about the so-called administrators bewildered by the influence of this age of quarrel, putting the state affairs into disorder. These verses are spoken thousands of years ago. And they're spoken out of compassion. How are the people going to make genuine progress in their life? They may have technology, they may have industry, but what about their internal development? That's where the real progress should be. So finally, in terms of scanning the external environment, I told our gathering last night a point that astonished so many. That in the USA, of all the religious dominations, the Catholics are the hardest hit in terms of losing members. Yet, an astonishing factor has emerged this year, that after 50 years of decline in women becoming nuns, I mean, who wants to become a nun? I mean, for 50 years it's been like that. You just have nuns who are 80 years old, 90 years old. Now, for the first time in 50 years, the numbers of women wanting to become nuns has jumped. And they describe, many of them, why they made that choice. I'm just tired of all this instability, all this commotion, all this relationship juggling, the false hopes for the dream job, the social pressure. It's too much. Why can't I just love God? So this is very extraordinary. I've talked to Catholic bishops, and they told me that, here are the facts. It may sound astonishing to you now. Right before World War II, if you wanted to be a Catholic monk or nun, you had to go on the waiting list. Because so many people were fried because of World War I, 17 million dead. And then in the late 1930s, they saw, oh no, another world war is coming. Oh, what kind of place is this? This is madness. So just to be a monk or a nun, you had to go on a long waiting list. And then after World War II, there was another boom. And you can understand why. So many people had seen so many atrocities during World War II, 54 million or so dead. They were horrified. They thought, what kind of world is this? I'm going to become a monk. I'm going to become a nun. Again, a waiting list. The waiting list to become a monk or a nun continued until you know when. The 60s. Free love, drugs, all this. That finished off the monasteries and nunneries in terms of young recruits, and they never recovered until today. So very interesting. It's quite astonishing that people, young people, are reacting to all the pressure they're under. They see that the dream is actually an hallucination. I would like purity. I would like authenticity. I'd like a life that's genuine. I'm tired of being a phony, pretending I'm happy and broadcasting all the phoniness on the social media. I'm tired of it. So yes, it would be easier for people if the social environment was more favorable. And that's why these verses are speaking as they do. They're not taking political sides. They're just pointing out the facts of the environment. That as long as animal slaughter, intoxication, illicit sexual connections, gambling, as long as that's advocated, don't expect peace. Expect massive problems individually, socially, and internationally, and what to speak of environmentally. All right, maybe there's some questions. Yes. Questions from our guests, welcome also. Maybe I said something wrong. We'll give our guests the first chance to string me up. Yes.
Yeah. What were we reading from? What were the verses on the screen? What's that from?
This is from the graduate study to Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita is the undergraduate study. Srimad Bhagavatam takes all the themes of Bhagavad Gita and expands on them. So it's known as the graduate study. It's like a spiritual encyclopedia. Many, many volumes. Thank you. You free to ask? Be my guest. Yes.
My question is somewhat unrelated. I just see a lot of different clothing, and I'm curious if the style of clothing and the color of clothing has any specific meaning.
Traditionally, those of us who are monks or monks in training wear various shades of saffron. And those who are married, or else those who are, their status is undecided, they wear white. And then there are some who just wear their regular clothes. It's as simple as that. Most devotees of Krishna, they're family persons, they're working jobs, and they have their spiritual dynamics of bhakti in the center of their life. Most are like that. Very few are monks. Very few. I'm sure you can understand why. And then the ladies, some of them are wearing traditional saris, and some are not. These things are external, though, by the way. Clothes don't make the person. Clothes don't make the spiritualist. But, you know, in terms of ordering social affairs, they give some help. That's all. You look at a person wearing saffron, you expect a certain behavior. That's all. A real human society is always well ordered. It's not chaotic like we have today. Very nice question. Thank you. From the back. Yes.
So you were saying, like, the goal is to reach not desiring, like, the things of this world, but desiring purely love of God. I was just wondering, like, if you have reached that and how you have reached that.
She's asking that you said the goal of life is to achieve pure love of God. Is that correct? She asked if I have achieved it, and if so, how do you achieve it? I'm aspiring for that. You see, real love has no ceiling. When you're dealing with affairs on the non-material platform, when you're dealing with affairs of the spiritual realm, there's no constraint by time and space. So the amazing thing about attraction to God, we say Krishna, because Krishna means the unlimitedly all-attractive person. The amazing thing is that the more you love God, the less you think you have love of God. Your appetite is never satiated. You want more and more and more. So you never think you have enough. Whereas material, so-called love, is always a problem of satiation, or what social researchers call the adaptation curve. I was explaining this last night a bit also. Adaptation curve means whatever material experience you do, and that's all that social researchers generally know about, whatever material experience you do starts off sizzling, slam bang at best, and then declines. So that's the curve. You start climbing on the curve. Wow, this is great. This is love. This is excitement. Awesome. And then down you go. So your whole life becomes a battle against this adaptation curve. You've got to keep the juice, keep the flavor, but you can't because you're dealing with a material situation ruled by time and space, which means there must be diminishment, there must be decline. And so that leads to frustration, anger, and of course you blame everyone except yourself. But on the spiritual platform, there are no such limitations. Therefore, the more love of God that you get, the more you want. So there's no limit. So you never think, now I have achieved. You think, there's so much more. I'm just standing on the shore of an endless ocean. Okay? How do you achieve it, you asked. You're asking me. I'm a devotee of Bhagavad Gita and Krishna. Our bhakti yoga texts explain that everything begins with the tongue. Vibrating spiritual sound, especially the Hare Krishna mantra, and tasting food offered to Krishna. Your spiritual life begins that simply. And of course, to understand all that process, we have so many books which explain the ins and outs. Naturally, birds of a feather flock together. So by associating with persons who want to go to that high level, you become inspired. So association plays a very important role. Very nice question. Hi.
Hi.
Yes.
You mentioned growing up in a Christian home.
Indeed. Proud of it.
Yeah. Could you kind of just explain what the shift was like for you from being in a Christian home to a devotee of Krishna?
When I was 5 years old, my mother told me, son, there are three things you got to be in order to be successful in life. Number one, you have to be a scholar. Number two, you have to be an entrepreneur. And number three, you got to be a Christian. So by the time I was 13, I was giving sermons in the Presbyterian Church. Shift, you say? I feel that I'm still pursuing my Christian goals, although in a, you may say, a different way, because I understand that Jesus taught love of God. So I want to know more about what is God so I can fulfill the commandment of Jesus to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy might. That's bhakti. That's pure devotion. Not my will, but thine be done. I always was intrigued by that as a little kid. Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, praying, Father, if possible, may I not have to go through this crucifixion? But then, no, not my will, but thy will be done. I was always intrigued by that as a kid. I said, wow, what kind of devotion is this? So, yes, when I became a teenager, you know it. Well, you're probably a saint since birth, but for me, you know, teenage years. And then, especially university years, you know. elitist university education, you know. But I was able to see that there is no material solution to all the material problems. So I wanted to go deep into pure devotion. And so therefore, Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita attracted me. How to love God without any material motivation. That goal, which we hold on high, so intrigued me and so fascinates me, even to this day. So yes, I tell my mother that I still think I'm following your instructions. We have a bit of a disagreement about that, of course, but... All right?
Are we, do you guys believe that we're able to get to God? There's such a love and passion to know God and to love Him more. Does it ever get to a point where you are with God?
Let me put it this way. Let's say you're a 5-year-old child and I put a diamond in your hand. The fact is you have the diamond, but you don't know it. What would a 5-year-old child do with a diamond? He'd probably try to swallow it or play marbles with it, throw it away. Still, the fact is the child has a diamond. So from the very beginning of the Krishna conscious process, the bhakti yoga process, from the very beginning, you are in contact with Krishna, but you may not know that. So the whole process of genuine yoga and meditation is to allow you to be conscious of what's happening, that you have contact with the Supreme Lord, but you're not aware of it. You're not conscious of it. You've got the diamond in your hand because you're following the process of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, but you're not aware of that. So the danger is you can throw away the jewel because you don't have a deep understanding of the treasure that's right in your hand. Beautiful question. Right in the back there.
Hey, this question might have a bit of a longer answer than we have time for, but I was just looking at like the beautiful display up here, and I was just noticing the three different parts of it, and I was wondering like what each part represents, or
what each part of. Oh, that's a deep question, which someone afterwards will be glad to answer, because if my mother would walk in. She's 91. She's still walking. She would, you know what she would say? Idol worship. So I have to explain to her that we're not worshiping concocted forms. And that would take quite some time to explain, especially to her, because what will be running through her mind all the time is graven image, idols manufactured according to human concoction. And it would take me a long time to explain that that is absolutely not the case. So we have our Western lenses. We have our Judeo-Christian lenses. And so we may just apply our conceptions and our traditions to something which is completely different. So yes, it's a barrier that we face all the time. What are those statues up there? What are you doing spending so much time dressing statues? So after class, someone will be glad to give you an in-depth explanation. It's very educational for our staff to hear these questions also, by the way, so don't feel shy. Yes.
I see the paintings and the images of AC, and I'm just wondering, do you believe like he ascended to become a deity? Or what is the view of AC?
Oh, he's our founder who brought pure... He's our founder who brought the science of pure devotion to Krishna outside of India and spread it all over the world. So therefore, we venerate him, we glorify him for his teaching how to love God purely. And yes, just like someone would feel gratitude toward Jesus Christ, which I certainly do, we feel gratitude toward him for representing God purely, no material motivation. How to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy might. So, we worship him not as God, but as the transparent medium, just like eyeglasses allow you to see better, but they don't interfere with what you're looking at. So similarly, the guru, a genuine guru, never says he or she is God. If you ever hear that, just walk out the door. Or if you're very bold, get a cream pie and put it on the person's face. A genuine guru says, I am the representative of God as I'm doing a humble service, like a mail person, USPS. I'm delivering the mail without changing it. I haven't opened the letter, the envelope, and changed the message. But this service of delivering the message of God is so extraordinary that you glorify the mail person for doing that job of that service of delivering the message of God without change, the message of pure devotion. So again, we don't worship and venerate His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, as God, but the servant of God is glorious just as God is, because the servant of God is doing the most precious task of giving the knowledge of God and the techniques for how to love God purely without any material motivation. So I hope that helps.
Yeah.
I was wondering what you believe about what happens after death, or what do your books say, like the Bhagavad Gita, say about what happens after death?
Very good question. Bhagavad Gita will tell you that death is just a phase, just like birth is just a phase. Krishna says that for one who has died, birth is certain, and for one who has been born, death is certain. So it's a revolving door. Popularly known as reincarnation, more precisely known as transmigration of the soul. Just like you change clothes, you change bodies. When your present clothes wear out, you put on new clothes, Krishna explains. Similarly, the soul changes from one body to another according to its mentality at the time of death. Now, I could shock you and point out the latest statistics which show that 20% or so of those calling themselves Christians believe in reincarnation. Don't burn them at the stake, please. So, yes. When your body is finished, you get another body according to your consciousness. But Bhagavad Gita wants to teach you, don't take another material body. It's just suffering. Whether high-class suffering or low-class suffering because it's material. Regain your spiritual existence in association with God, in association with Krishna. Okay? Thank you. Yes.
Thank you for all your answering of our questions. You've done amazing. My question kind of tags in with what you had said in two answers ago. You said we're very thankful for Jesus too. I just didn't know. Do you consider him a good guru, or where do you guys land on that?
We consider Jesus the purest servant of God. He's our guru. We adore him. Okay. He taught pure love of God. Whether his message is carried out purely these days, you know better than I. But he taught the pure reality. If anyone calls themselves my follower, let them take up my cross and follow me. Yes.
So that goes directly off that in Jesus. And then you mentioned take up your cross. So in the Bible that we believe that he did take up his cross and he died on the cross. What do you believe that solution was? Do you believe that was a materialistic solution, therefore like invalid, or how do you view the cross?
How we view the cross? This is the ultimate sacrifice. He said, thou shalt not kill. And misunderstanding, people killed him. He's demonstrating how to sacrifice everything for the will of the Father. So that's so inspiring for us. We accept it 100%. He taught love of God. We want to know more about God the Father. One instruction, when I'm speaking, especially at yoga schools, one instruction in the New Testament that I often quote is, we have to be in the world, but not of the world. Now, that is high spiritual technology if you really want to get into it. It's like saying you have to be submerged in the ocean and not be wet. So Bhagavad Gita is all about that applied spiritual technology about how to be in the world but not of the world. Yes.
You talked about the age of Kali, I think it was.
Oh, you caught that one.
I'm not familiar with that, so I was wondering if you could talk a little more about it.
It simply means the age of quarrel and darkness. This, the text here will tell you they were spoken thousands of years ago. But they're looking ahead. These seers are looking ahead and they're perceiving the onslaught of an age which degrades all the fine qualities of human beings. So what you're hearing is futuristic, although it's happening now. So right now, according to the Bhakti Yoga text, we are in the present age of darkness, which makes it very difficult to make spiritual advancement. We think we have made so much progress. Oh, look at our technology. Look at our industry. Look at our military. But actually, when it comes to the real achievements that a human being should have, we're in a mess. And we can see that by looking at the environment, by looking at our social situation. So yes, that's what the age of Kali means. Human beings are bewildered thinking, oh, we're so great. And they can't even see that they've become so destructive of themselves, of their environment, of the world. But no, no, never before has humanity been so advanced.
Okay. Just sort of a quick one.
You've been waiting.
Yeah, this is a quick one, sorry. There's like the large statue up there. It's like on the balcony thing.
Oh, yes.
And is that Krishna or is that
someone else? Just like in Christianity, in some forms of Christianity, you hold to the existence of angels. Similarly, there are beings that are more powerful than human beings, but they're not God. Did I get out of that one pretty good? All right. It's been such a pleasure having you all here. I thank you very much. Hare Krishna.